Ways and Means for February 9th, 2005. As everybody may be aware, Senator Gordley is at home recovering from an illness, and she will probably join us either later this week or the first part of next week. Other members should be considered excused. I'm anticipating the other members will be here. Mr. Myers has been sort of on a short rope, I think, for two or three meetings this week, and I think he's actually going to finally come up and testify today. The reason I asked Mr. Meyer to come forward, and Lashen arranged it, was that he has a fairly good presentation. I shouldn't say fairly good. That sounds like it's not quite. A good presentation on the school formula. And I know we've had a short presentation on it before, but I think that there might be some additional questions on the committee. And he's also going to, I think, go into some of the history on the formula in terms of how it was put together, I believe, and to some degree, not to a lot, but years, and the changes that have occurred to the formula over time. Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Steve Meyer with the Legislative Revenue Office. I feel a little bit out of place here because I'm used to being on the other end of the hall, and I'm not used to having senators and representatives on the same committee, so if I misspeak, please excuse that. You should have a handout in slide form titled School Equalization Formula History, 1991 to 2005. Let me just make clear up front that I didn't deal with all of the legislation involved here since 1991. 1991, I was working on property taxes and Major 5 numbers and wasn't directly involved in school finance. So what I know about the first three sessions, first 6 years generally, is secondhand information and not firsthand. So if I make an error, I'm sure I'll be corrected by those who were around here during that time and have firsthand experience yet, although that number is getting smaller by the year. Hopefully that won't happen. It'd be necessary, though. I guess I wanted to just lay the groundwork briefly with the slide labeled before 1991. At the time, we had the old property tax system. We had districts that were considered property poor and property rich in terms of the assessed value that existed per student. That still exists today. That's one thing that hasn't changed since pre-1991. The only thing, the big change in that is that timber at that time was still part of the assessment roll, standing timber, and that has changed. So from that standpoint, there's a small difference, but we still have the high wealth districts and the poor districts in assessed value assets. We had the old school distribution formula that was 70% for basic grant and transportation and 30% for equalization. The basic grant was not a dollar amount per student. It was an amount of the approved program so that districts that had more money could be spending more on their approved program than other districts. The transportation was at 60% rather than the 70% that it is now. And the 30% for equalization for those property poor districts did not cover all districts. I don't know offhand how many did receive some equalization dollars, but it wasn't near all of the districts. Perhaps half. I don't have that information. Another thing that was going on was that there were legal challenges to distribution systems in other states, primarily concerning property wealth per student. The result districts that had made the same property tax or tax rate effort were getting different amounts of revenue because of the different wealth amounts per district. And so that was in the courts. And then, of course, Measure 5. Measure 5 said that the state had to make up for lost property taxes, but it did not give any guidelines as to how that money should be distributed. So that's hopefully kind of sets the stage for the 1991 session. Just a few comments about that session. There was no committee interim work leading up to that session about what school finance should be and how money should be distributed. So that, and there, consequently, there was a work group during that session outside of the committee process that was trying to come up with a formula. And there were several different people on that working group, the usual suspects around the building that participated, as well as staff and a nationally known consultant, considered an expert in school finance, was also played an advisory role to that work group. But there's little in the way of written records of as to what that committee considered, what kind of data they had, what kind of issues were involved. But they did craft a formula that I think was that they considered at the time would survive a court challenge. And consequently, you have a major movement towards equalization. Another thing that was expected at that time was that there would be substantial changes to the formula that they developed, either in the 93 session or succeeding sessions. And I think as we go through this, we'll see that that didn't happen very much. The major expectation and way of changing the formula was the possible adoption of some kind of price index or cost index that wasn't in the formula initially. Whether it was something to deal with a wage index or a cost of living index or cost of doing business for schools, something along that kind was expected to be added to the formula and has not been. The working group came up with four principles or guidelines that they used to develop the formula to help them make decisions as to what form it should take. The first was to share school funding sources statewide. And the way to do that then was to allocate all major state and local operating revenue. The old formula had a narrower definition of local revenue than the new formula. The old formula just used federal force fees and property taxes. The new formula added to that things like the common school fund, a county school fund, state managed timber revenue, and a couple other minor sources. The second principle was to let each district decide how to spend its allocation. No micromanagement.
Yes.
Is this state timber revenue thing that you've got in the formula you're talking about, is that statutory? Or is that been adopted by...
It's statutory.
It is.
Okay. Yes, Representative Jensen. And these distribution principles are not in statute, by the way. They were just policy guidelines at the time and not incorporated into any statutes.
Okay,
Second was to let each district decide how to spend its allocation, basically not to try to micromanage at the district level and to give state aid in a lump sum rather than categorical grants. And so there weren't any restrictions really placed upon how the money could be spent by the district. Third, to adjust funding only for uncontrollable cost differences. And the method then was to try to justify revenue differences in a rational manner. Here's where you get into the student weights. The district had no control over how many special education students might live in the district. It had no control over how far away from the schools the districts lived, how much their transportation costs would be. Those kinds of uncontrollable costs. They had no control over how many students in the district were from poverty families, for example. And so those are the kinds of cost factors then that got incorporated into the formula. Fourth, to avoid incentives to increase district allocation. And the method to do that then was to minimize classifications and set limits. So basically try to have as few classifications as you can so that there wasn't much in the way that the districts could do to try to put students in a class that would generate more revenue for those students. And one of the limits that I'll mention is on the IEP students, that only up to 11% of the students could only be considered IEP for that weight unless they went through the waiver process. 11% at that time was about the state average. And of course, you've heard already that the state average now is more like 13%. Okay. Then
yes, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you account for this increase in the state average on this? Beyond the 11%.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I think that was touched on earlier. There's several reasons, and I can't recall all of them, but one is advances in medical technology in terms of special education students surviving or being part of the school system. Another is more awareness of parents that those services were available, and some other factors like that that helped drive up that count.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Oops.
Are there any school districts in Oregon that have less than 11% special ed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, yes, I would say so. Some small districts may only have none or one or two out of 20 students or 30 students. So, yes, there are a few that are less than 11%.
Follow, please.
Yes.
But the preponderance of the districts are at the 11% cap.
Mr. Chair, I would say that the majority are between 11% and 14%. There's a narrow range around the 13% average.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Then for 1991 legislation, they decided to make the first year, the 1991-92, a transition year, so the formula was not in effect at that time. And then also decided to phase in the equalization formula beginning in 92-93, probably because of not having complete data that was needed to actually calculate the formula. That first year, the funding was proportional to what had been distributed in 1990-91, the prior year. And it was also decided that the low-funded districts should be brought up gradually, rather than try to bring them up to what the formula said that they should have all in one year, one time, so that the districts would have some time for planning and to be able to, I think, spend the money more wisely rather than getting a larger amount all very quickly in that first year. But this, and also to hold harmless the high revenue districts. So this gives you some idea of the original intent was to raise up the low funded districts to a level of the high funded districts. It wasn't necessarily initially to collapse the high funded districts down, but to bring the low up.
Clarification on that, Mr. Meyer. When you say high funded districts, it was generally to bring them up to the general level of higher funded districts, not to the highest level, because there were some that were
very high.
Very high.
Yes. And then part of that session, too, was to merge elementary and high school districts, where we had the old system of union high school districts and elementary districts. Nothing to do directly with the formula, but that was also part of the legislation at that time. Okay, then in 1991, after that initial equalization formula could be characterized as state revenue plus local revenue equals the sum of two grants, a general purpose grant and a transportation grant, where you have all of the student weights coming into play and the teacher experience factor coming into play into the general purpose grant, and then approved transportation costs in the 70% in that portion. If you look at this, you can go back and pretty much match things up with one of the four principles that was agreed upon for guidelines. But I won't go into trying to point that all out. What I wanted to do is just give you a rough idea of what the formula is not about because of what's happened since 1991. It's not a general cost reimbursement formula, although there's elements of cost reimbursement in the formula, especially transportation. There's no entitlement factor in the formula. There's no set dollar amount that should be available for each student. There's nothing about funding adequacy. The formula works no matter what the appropriation level is. There's nothing about student outcomes or achievements in terms of driving revenue to districts based upon those results. There's nothing about what the quantity of inputs have to be in the education system, either at the district level or at the school site level. Nothing about program quality. that gets you more or less funding, and nothing about accountability. Most of those topics weren't really at the forefront of the school finance discussion in 1991. They came after that for the most part. What the formula is about is defining school district equity. If you accept that the formula as is, as the legislature has defined it, is the, quote, definition, unquote, of equity, then they accomplished their mission in that 1991 session. Okay? But basically, it's a way to measure the fairness of the revenue distribution system. And the way that's measured is to try to come up with the relative need of districts, not an absolute need, but a relative need based upon student characteristics and some district characteristics. Okay. So given the amount of money, how much does District A need given its student characteristics versus District B with perhaps some different student characteristics of their student body? I think they also reflected to some extent the finance issues and the court decisions that were at the forefront in the 1980s. Basically, the issue about equal dollars for equal tax effort, again, going back to the property tax system at the time, and what was happening about that equal revenue for equal tax effort in other states. And then subsequently to 91, refining the definition of equity by changes in the legislative policy over the last 10 or 12 years. Now, from there, I guess I would just like to briefly go through each session and list the highlights of what happened in that session.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Meyer. I had this presentation during the interim, and I appreciate it. It's very informative. Do you have a list of those legislative policies that you could provide? Your last bullet on page slide 8.
I think what follows will be those policies in the subsequent sessions.
Thank you.
In 1993, the legislature adjusted the floor and ceiling constraints. Basically, what are the upper and lower limits for funding? It specified that no decrease should be more than 10%. In that 93-94 year, again, limiting how fast and not bringing the somewhat high districts down. And then also it changed the formula definition of property taxes to the amount collected and not the imposed. This was because some districts, they might impose taxes, but the percentage of that imposed collected would vary from district to district. So they went to the collection amount. And that would also include the collections for prior years that were paid in the current year. And then they also had legislation not related directly to the formula, but it was about ESD mergers. And so there, you've already heard a little bit about, well, no, that was a different committee. You'll hear more about that today, I think. And then there was also a change in what was considered local revenue for certain special costs that affected the Portland School District. In 1995, again, there was a guarantee of 95% of prior year revenue, again, bringing the upper districts down very slowly and concentrating on bringing the low-funded districts up to the formula amount. There was an adjustment for the remote small school distance factor. Prior to that, the school districts had to be a certain distance from the next nearest school to qualify. The legislature said, well, you don't have to be just that far. If you're close to that, then you will partially qualify. You won't get the full extra weights for being remote, but you're considered, you know, on the edge, partially remote, and will qualify for some. And then the other change on the weights was to include white CEP students at a double weight. The Youth Correction Education Program students were included in the formula. They had been funded in the prior session out of the state school fund, but not from the formula. So this was a change. And that also directed that there be an evaluation of the cost of living factor during the interim. The interim committee did look at that and came up with a cost to actually do a study, but did not actually carry out a study.
Mr. Meyer, in 1995, I think it's approximately about then, I don't have the name off the top of my head, but the first, there was a court case in, I think, about 1995, challenging the legislature and the state on that they were not bringing the districts up to equalization. And if I remember correctly, the general, there were two court cases, the one then and then one about 3 years later. The first one, I think the courts held basically that the state was making a good faith effort.
Yes.
And the second one, although they were post the 99 session, the ultimate judgment of the court was what we anticipated, was that we hadn't made a good faith effort, and that's why in 99 we tried to push equalization a lot harder than we had before. I just wanted to get that in. Those cases, I think, were, if I remember correctly, one of them was Bend Lapine, and I think the other, one of the other parties was Beaverton in that. So, please go ahead.
Okay. There were a couple of studies that dealt with a cost index. One prior to 95 and one in 97. But that was a topic of discussion in the 90s, but then it kind of faded after that. In 1997, you have kind of the formalization of the floor and ceiling, where the state and local revenue was to be the greater of the prior year revenue, which was considered a stop-loss grant, or the prior year revenue per student times the current year number of students, which was called a flat grant per student, or the equalization revenue. So those three calculations were done for each school district, and then the amount was the highest of those three. And that was in effect for 4 years. There were some other modifications, but that was the basic calculation. The other thing that started in 97 was to phase down the high revenue districts. Right? By that time, it was getting clear that you weren't going to bring up all the low-funded districts to a high level. And so it was thought that we better get started in bringing the very high down to a reasonable level and meet somewhere in the middle. And so that was started. It was to be phased in over 3 years, with bringing them down by one-third to $4,800 per student. That year was also the first year to make a change in the number of grants to the formula. A facility grant was added at 6% of construction costs, up to $10 million per year. The 97, remember, had ballot measure 47 and ballot measure 50, which constricted the districts on what could be bonded. It couldn't include things that were not intrinsic to the structure. So equipment and furnishings on the interior couldn't be bonded, and so this was to help compensate for those costs and to help the high-growth districts that were adding new buildings. And then 99 legislation, it changed that facility grant to 8%, or $17.5 million per biennium. The 8% has not been reached because of the dollar cap. It was about 3% in the old 103 biennium. It was decided to phase out the small high school distance adjustment to the remote small school weight, so that small high schools could qualify whether they were close to another high school or not. And also those that were only getting a partial weight would now get the full weight after that was fully phased in. So that added some weights to the formula in going through that phase in. Not a formula, but also the first real legislation that dealt with the local option. Measure 50 said school districts could have a local option only if the legislature gave them that authority. And in 97 or 99 then, that was started at $500 per student, or 10% of direct formula revenue. There was legislation in 97 dealing with that topic, but it didn't take effect because another bill was passed by the voters. And then also began the temporary ESD equalization for the biennium. So the lowest ESDs, or those that were below average per student, were brought up a little bit, with the lowest being brought up a little bit more per student than those that were closer but still below the average. In 2001, for the lack of new legislation on formula constraints, the equalization formula was fully implemented. All districts' revenue was from the formula calculation, no exceptions. The juvenile correction education students were added at a half weight, just like the youth correction students had been added before. So this, again, were new weights included in the formula to, again, be a factor to increase those weights over time. There was legislation to equalize the local option revenue for the low-wealth districts, again, going back to saying, well, if they have a local option and they make a certain tax effort in terms of the tax rate, that local option should raise a certain amount of revenue. Four districts qualify out of the 17 local option districts. That gives you some idea of the districts that the districts that are passing a local option tend to be the districts that have higher property value per student. There aren't too many low ones that qualify for the equalization of the local option.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
In fact, the nature of that equalization would make it somewhat impractical for the higher tax base districts to even have a local option. Is that not correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, there's no incentive for the higher property value districts to have a local option to qualify for equalization, if I can put it that way.
Yeah.
Because they wouldn't.
They wouldn't.
But there is an incentive for a lower value district in terms of to have a local option because they would qualify for equalization.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Yeah.
And then the other point is that the 2001 legislation began the phase-in of ESD equalization and also a phase-in of what the share of the ESD should be for the total revenue available, both state and local revenue, both school districts and ESDs. So that's when the phase up to their 5% of that total amount began. And it was about 4.6%, I believe, at that time. So a gradual phase up of less than a half of a percent. Okay, 2003 legislation, you're very familiar with that yet in terms of the changes in the transportation grant. The highest 20% of the districts got either 90% or 80% of their approved transportation costs included in the formula, and the rest stayed at the 70%. And then you had the
clarification on that, just so the increase in transportation grant from 20% of districts, although it increases for 20% of districts, those are high-cost districts, and by no means does it represent 20% of the student population. I think it's generally significantly lower. It's 20% of the districts.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. I did say districts, but you're good point.
Please proceed.
And then the high-cost disability grant at $25,000, costs in excess of $25,000 per student, but again with a $12 million limit, going back to one of those principles to set limits. And there'll be legislation proposed to extend that legislation, otherwise it will sunset. And then finally, they increased the local option to $750 per student or 15% of formula revenue. So basically, that's the second change from what was initially proposed. So you have the current formula then looking much as it did initially. State and local revenue equals the general purpose grant, transportation grant, with two new grants, the high-cost disability grant and the facility grant. And I won't go through each of the changes in each of the grants, but that's another day. But again, the change hasn't been very much. There's been changes in the weights. There's been changes in some of the percentages. There's been changes in terms of what costs are recognized. But the basic principles are still there, and the basic form is still there. If you look at the chart the equalization chart, you can see then what has happened comparing the 91-92, I believe is the year I had. Yes, and this is revenue per weighted student. I ranked them based upon weighted student estimates for 91-92. They are estimates since the formula wasn't in effect that year. And you can see that the range was from 3,000 to over 5,000. It would have been much higher if I'd included all the small districts under the $500 per ADM. And then you can see how the equalization district distributes money to those districts and how much more even it is in terms of the range around the average. It looks more like a thin saw blade edge than a rising sloped line. So I guess that still leads to the question as to why has the formula changed so little over this time period? And I don't have a specific answer for that, but I think it probably can be related back to initially the concern was about what were the constraints, what were the limits, how fast did you get to the formula, not what the formula itself was, because a lot of the districts were affected by the constraints and not the formula initially. And then secondly, once districts got, a lot of the districts got near the formula, they were pretty used to getting that amount, and it's almost like, well, there's a status quo effect now. And any changes you make creates winners and losers, as was talked about Monday, and so that makes it more difficult to implement any change. And perhaps that will continue, I don't know, but we'll see how some of those other issues that are current today come into play, and perhaps will cause the legislature to reconsider a more drastic change to the formula in the future.
Mr. Meyer, although you were not involved in the very early sessions on this issue, you have been involved in a number of the sessions since
yes.
that time. I'm not personally planning on proposing any change in the weights, but can you let us tell us whether or not in those the weighting factors of whether in the hearings you've had in previous sessions there has been a discussion of weighting factors and generally has there been supportive evidence of the relative merits of the weighting factors that were originally selected?
Mr. Chair, there has been discussions and debate about whether those weights should remain what they are or be changed.
Probably in both directions, I would guess.
In some instances, yes. The problem has always been a lack of data to support a change and how much of a change. And the database initiative was to help get at that issue. And now, as you heard yesterday, that they feel like that data is getting better and better each year, I think that there will be re-evaluations of those weights with that data now. Whether that will lead to a change or not, I don't know.
Any questions for Mr. Meyer? Well, thank you very much for thank you for coming back at least twice.
You're welcome.
We will move on. Good morning, Ms. Fleming.
Good morning.
I guess we have three superintendents
Mr. Chair,
in the
actually
audience.
We have four.
Oh, we have
we
four
added one, yes, overnight.
So I'm not saying this sarcastically. Today we're going to get sort of an overview of the exciting area of educational service districts. So, Ms. Fleming, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's great to be back in front of you this morning.
Sure.
Absolutely. As you know, we had planned to talk about the education service districts last week, and due to changes in the schedule, have invited them to come in this week to tell you firsthand what it is that they do. And they've organized their presentation around a proposal that we hope that you'll take under consideration. But before we turn it over to them, I just want to give some opening remarks that are repetitive for Senator Walker, but she isn't here, so this will help frame, I think, what the value and the importance of the Education Service District system is to the Oregon Department of Education. We have two handouts that we've brought for you this morning. One is a map of what the current system looks like with the 20 ESDs, and in fact, our GIS map is not even currently updated. Yamhill County is, in fact, now a part of Willamette ESD's region, so Polk, Marion, and Yamhill counties are together in one region. And the other document that you have is a spreadsheet that lists all of the current 0305 contracts that we have by ESD, so you can get a sense of what it is that we ask them to do on behalf of the children that we serve in terms of direct services and other grant programs. We talked a little bit last week about how the department predicated its reorganization on the ESDs being a critical component of a statewide system of service delivery and support for school improvement. We talked a little bit about the fact that with the demands of No Child Left Behind, that the mission and the resources at the department have been deployed in a different way, and we need to be spending more time on data quality, data collection, data analysis, research, and the development of those content standards and measuring against those standards with our assessment system as a primary focus of our mission, which leaves, in fact, the system of support for school improvement to happen most readily somewhere else. And so we have looked to that system of education service districts to help us figure out how we can do that better over time. And many of those ESDs are already doing that, have been doing it for a number of years, but now we need to sort of ramp up the effort. This is part of our notion of an enterprise approach, which is really about, in the system, the role of an intermediary organization, or in a corporate environment, probably what you would consider to be middle management, is really critical for connecting us to the schools and school districts in the regions where they reside. We can work much easier and more effectively with 20 education service districts than we can with 198 school districts, so we rely on them a great deal for communication, for pulling together a variety of constituents, groups, curriculum directors, technology directors, assessment directors, and indeed most of them convene a superintendent council, and that helps us a lot with our communication, et cetera. We mentioned last week that we've tried to differentiate our role at the department between steering and rowing, steering again being policy and leadership and regulation, and rowing being service delivery and compliance. And so we, again, are relying on that group of education service districts to provide that service delivery and indeed help us with the compliance around state and federal mandates. I don't want to belabor the point, but again, the increased expectations with the implementation of No Child Left Behind, the move in the system to an expectation of performance management at the same time that we have budget constraints, that we need to use our existing capacity differently, and that the work that we've been doing with the ESDs over the last couple of years to create that memorandum of understanding and more clearly define what it is that we do with them and how we do it, how the contracts get let, how the procurement happens, and Brett can answer any questions you might have about that, have been an important part of redefining that relationship and that set of transactions that we do. In your notebook, you have a section that has the memorandum of understanding template and the signed memorandums that we have from all of the ESDs. They've taken those MOUs to their boards. They've considered them, discussed them, and signed them and sent them back to us. And we're missing, I think, only two at this point in time, and well, we expect those to come in soon. The relationship, as a result of that development of the MOU, we've worked together to really revise and update and refine our procurement practices It's there are some services that need to be provided on a regional basis, some that are more localized, and so the MOU has helped us really define what it is that we put out for competitive bid versus what it is we go to a geographic regional service provider first and have that ESD system have the first right of refusal, if you will, for some of the programs, youth corrections, for example. We've increased our communication and interaction. As I said, last summer we took a portion of our Title I funds that we had available for school improvement and started a pilot project, which I think Dr. Maureen Casey will talk to you about hopefully this morning, has resulted in increasing our capacity for that set of school improvement efforts that I mentioned. And the repetitive theme that we hear when we talk to district superintendents about ESDs is the need for an equity of services to look at. We know that there's a huge disparity in Senator Nelson's neck of the woods relative to access to course content and strategies that are developed in ESDs like the Frontier Learning Network, for example, really help address those disparities. And some of those entrepreneurial activities that the ESDs are engaged in help bring resources back to local districts. So the other thing, the last thing I'll mention that we've done with them is the system of education service districts reports to a set of locally elected school boards. The standards that are on the books for us at the department to manage and oversee really define what we define as a set of standards for education service districts. We're required to collect an annual report that we've constructed with them, and that tells us whether or not they've met the standard. The annual report, as we came in to take a look at it, was not particularly relevant or helpful to them at a local level. So that's been part of what we've done with them is revise the annual report that they send in to us so we get a better sense, and they have a better sense of what they need to report to their local constituent districts, and there's some consistency to that. So the OAESD proposal... this morning, the four superintendents that are here to talk to you are going to talk about the four components of defining a core delivery system, what it is that ESDs do, and they're going to give you that explanation in context so that they can tell you the story for how it looks in their geography. And then I think they'd be happy to answer any questions, and I would as well.
Representative Wisdom. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Fleming. This past summer, we had an embarrassing situation happen in one of our ESDs. Have you produced some lessons learned? Have you got some proposed legislation to help us prevent that in the future? We talked about that this summer. I think it's really important that we look at this, address this session.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnant, absolutely, we've learned many lessons, and we're still learning them as we go through this process with addressing the concerns that emerged in the Union Baker ESD. We part of this conversation with the group of ESDs is about what the relationship is to us in the role of accountability, both oversight for financial and fiscal responsibilities in their constituent districts. I believe that this proposal that is being brought forward today is going to help us clarify that. They have admittedly a role in that accountability equation, and I think the devil is in the details. It is about what we ask them to do on our behalf, on your behalf, for the enterprise that we need to more clearly define. But this will probably leak into the realm of the conversation about audits, which is another one of the reasons why we brought that clarified concept paper to you about what we mean about different aspects of auditing and what it is that you want to have happen in the system. The rigor and scope of financial audits did not, in that particular instance, did not reveal or uncover the things that probably should have been revealed and uncovered, and that is under investigation by the Board of Accountancy, and we're waiting to for them to finish their investigation before we inquire on our own if there are unanswered questions.
Yes, follow up. Thank you. I think as we discussed this summer, one of the problems we had is we're not sure what your authority is. Has that been clarified? Has that been legally interpreted that you do have an authority to go in to put a person on the ground to oversee that? so that we don't have the people still operating and spending taxpayers' money that are being charged with illegal acts, or they're being charged with misuse of funds. So, I mean, that was the problem we had, is it seemed like, you know, we had a problem that had been identified by the press and by other people, and you weren't sure what your role was, if you could go in there and put someone in charge and to be sure that the cleaning up was done properly. Has that been determined by your department and by the Attorney General of what your role is in a situation like this, where the elected officials are the ones that we're worried about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnant, I think the statutes and rules are clear. We have hired a person as our agent in the field to work with a superintendent, who in fact is hired and reports to a locally elected board. The representative that we've hired is in constant communication with us and with the Attorney General, and I think there is some action pending this week that maybe Brett can provide greater detail about. Again, the governance system with education service districts is that we don't have direct authority to hire and fire their staff. In fact, they are governed by a locally elected board. So we have to rely on the standards that are proposed in the statutes and rules, and to make sure that under that authority we've had the opportunity to know whether or not they've met those standards.
Final statement.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you. I appreciate your keeping me informed this summer and your do and take action, but I still would go back to, I think that we need leadership in proposing some legislation. You're saying that there's not any on the table. Is that correct, that you're going to be proposing to address this? That would be the last thing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnant, the Department of Education is not proposing any legislation. We would be happy to work with the committee and with any representatives that would be proposing legislation to address those accountability issues and the content of that.
Ms. Fleming, I don't want to belabor this point now because we have the four superintendents here. But I do know under some circumstances, and I don't know if it's under federal legislation or state legislation, the superintendent does have the authority to take over the management of a district. Does that extend to an ESD?
Mr. Chair, yes. Actually, the administrative rule, and I don't have it in front of me, but it reads that if the district is found to be non-standard, the superintendent has the authority to mandate a merger with a contiguous ESD, which would be as far as probably we could imagine going. We have.
Can you define non-standard in the sense of?
Well, it would relate to all the aspects of the operation, and right now in the particular instance of Union Baker ESD, the issue is really financial solvency and whether or not they have the ability to manage fiscally to the extent that we would expect to be accountable for the funds that we send there or not. That'd be the primary concern.
Representative Jensen.
I appreciate what the department is saying here, but it strikes me that the real responsibility is what's the case as far as the students in that district. That is the area that we need to have some accountability for, rather than, and I'm not downplaying the significance of the financial accountability, but if the mission of the SD or the mission of a school is not being met, that is, provide the education to the children of the state or the children of that district, then it strikes me that somehow or another the State Department of Education should be in a position to step in and do something with it. And I give you, and I don't mean to drag dirty laundry in front of the committee, as such, but I give you the illustration with the mental health clinic in my district that was failing in their obligation to provide the services that are outlined in statute, federal and otherwise, and the state doesn't have any authority. Well, yeah, they do have some authority, but they did painfully come in and make an impact on, and eventually the county turned over the operation, at least temporarily, to the state. So I know we can get lost in money, but it's the kids that I'm concerned about.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I think you've just sort of hit on the tension in the system that we've come to at this point in time, which is a locally elected governance system and a state-funded school budget. Just wanted to remind you that we, in fact, did terminate contracts from Union Bank or ESD at the point. We do have the authority, obviously, to do that. And the additional tension that's created in the system now comes with the federal intervention and the sanctions and consequences that NCLB, No Child Left Behind, forces us to manage. And we are just now in the... We have one district that's in the fourth year of that sanction cycle, and it requires us to do one of seven things, one of which is take over the school district, take over the management of the district. In our conversations with the district, obviously we would prefer not to do that and have no intention of becoming that heavy-handed in the way that we manage those sanctions. But rather, what we need is to identify what it is that's not happening for the students in that district and be able to provide the support and the resources for them to actually address those needs and get better at what they need to do. And so it's a matter of art rather than science in terms of how we get that to happen. ESDs can be very helpful to us in that equation.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The district I represent includes at least Union County, but I'd kind of like to take a little bit more global view. Actually, there's three SDs out in my district, Umatilla-Morrow County, which has a view of consolidation, very well-run operation. You have the Baker Union County, which evidently was not very well-run and is in very dire trouble right at the moment. And then I have Wallowa County, which I believe on this map is Region 18. Is that right? I think it's Region 18. That's a county. It's a smaller county, but they actually return money to the state school fund. I mean, they're very well-run. So, I mean, when we're talking about we've got one ESD that's really not doing very well, did some very bad things. There's a lot of them that are doing really a pretty good, decent job. And going back to what Representative Jensen is saying, it's delivery of services to the children. And we've got, I mean, when I look at this, it seems like this ESD issue is sort of compacted in my district because you got one group that wants consolidation, one group that wants to stay independent, and then you've got one group that just basically wants the ESDs to go away. Or there's all this whole spectrum, so we get back to the question of delivery of service, and I guess in maybe a question to you in consolidation, if you have to deliver their services, where are any potential savings if we consolidate, say, Eastern Oregon in just the two education service districts, you know, with a huge amount of distances that we have to deal with out there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, yes, and I believe the conversation we had yesterday really unveiled a lot of those rural issues, and in fact, the cost savings may not be as great in the representation in the rural communities as they might be in the metropolitan area. The cost savings really come from, as Ozzie Rose will tell you, come from people. And the cost savings is you get rid of jobs, and that's a very difficult conversation in your part of the country because those jobs are very important to the communities where they reside. From our perspective at the State Department, in terms of managing your investment effectively and efficiently, I want to just reinforce that it's much easier for us to deal with 20 ESDs than it is to deal with 198 districts on a day-to-day or a contractual basis. So we still want a regional service delivery system that works, that helps push us toward some kind of equity of service delivery for the needs of the students in those districts. Again, want to keep reinforcing the idea that we do have a different game with No Child Left Behind than we have had in the past, and that it squeezes us to really take more aggressive action and to be more collaborative in the way that we work out in the system.
Yes. Comment. I mean, the distance is something that I don't think a lot of people understand. From Pendleton or Grand or Enterprise, it's actually closer for us to drive to Portland than it is for us to drive to Bend. Mm-hmm. And people sort of put all of us out there in Eastern Oregon under one thing. I mean, going to Klamath Falls is, I mean, the distance, if you just divided that into two areas out there, I mean, I think you're going to find that the delivery of service to the children is just not going to work. Somebody's going to get left out.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, when I was in my younger years, I drove from a small rural ESD to a remote location, so I'm well aware as a speech pathologist what that drive means. I think there are probably representative examples that the superintendents that are going to be before you could talk about in terms of how they've managed placing staff creatively in facilities, sharing office space with community colleges and local school districts so that people don't end up having to drive truly from a central location, and that they're managed from a central location but don't necessarily have to live there or reside there to get the services to the kids that need them.
Senator Whitson.
Yes, Chair Devlin. I would just reiterate what Senator Nelson has been saying, and I know you're aware of that. North Lake is within Lake, in the Lake District. North Lake is at least 2 hours, 2.5 hours in good weather from Lakeview, and Klamath Falls is almost as close to Lakeview as North Lake is. It seems to me with the ESDs, we're looking at economy of scale, and the purpose in my mind of an ESD is to consolidate that economy of scale into an area so that each different district in these remote areas doesn't have to have the same facility and the same staff to share. It seems to me that the place to focus that reduction, if we're going to do a reduction, would be in the areas, in the more urban areas, the more consolidated areas where the districts themselves may have the, and I know you don't want to deal with more districts, but the districts themselves may have that that ability, whereas in the rural part of the state, the individual districts do not have that ability. So I think that the ESDs, in my mind, are a great deal more necessary in the rural areas than they are in the urban areas, and I believe that something like 80% of the people in Oregon live within 20 miles of the Willamette River, and when you look at this map, there's where the school districts are too. You know, I mean, so.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, you just hit upon something I think that is not always very clear or obvious in terms of the role of an ESD, and that in my experience, having worked, and I think this was part of the testimony in Senate education this week, that a value-added function that ESDs provide is that they bring people together to talk about economies of scale, sharing services, developing programs collaboratively. The example that I would use from my own experience is in Polk County, there are four school districts, two very small, two medium size. When the original law came out, we had to talk about implementing the Certificate of Advanced Mastery. Each of those districts recognized that they couldn't afford to implement the whole certificate by themselves, so they came together and figured out ways to collaborate and develop programs that were complementary for students. In fact, geographically, they're only about 15 miles apart, so it was easy to either move faculty or kids from one location to another so that they could develop signature programs and services individually that kids could share collectively for their high school experience. That's just one of those sort of hidden values in that convening of the superintendent core that I think is really an important one, and it often gets overlooked and it's harder to quantify.
Ms. Fleming, did Mr. West have any? No. Okay. I think given the hour and given the fact that we have four superintendents here, and I don't think it's really possible probably to get an understanding of ESDs without having both the Department of Education and the superintendents present. I did want to state for the record that even though there's going to be some discussion of the proposal that's been put together by the ESDs and the governor's office and the Department of Education. It is no way a statement that this committee has made any decision on this issue. My full purpose in this was knowing that there's going to be some legislation coming either from the Senate or the House or both on this issue, ultimately to this committee, and not knowing when it will come, not knowing how much basically push there will be on the legislation when it gets here, just trying to make sure that the committee is aware of some of the issues, and I know many of them are aware of it already, but I'm just trying to ensure that Senator Walker is obviously in her committee spending a lot of time on this issue, and I believe actually Representative Flores will be also in her committee. So could we bring this two of the superintendents up at a time? And we'll spend about 30 minutes on the first two and 30 minutes on the second two so that we can ensure that everybody has a chance to talk.
I will let them introduce
themselves.
And Ozzie
can come up with them also if he'd like. And we can add an extra chair on the corner that would be
Chair,
fine.
Our plan for presentation would be that I'll be last and I'll go over the proposal that we've developed over the last 6 months.
Okay.
After they talk to you about current way things have been.
Well,
okay.
Then can the chair will change his direction then. Can we do about 20 minutes on each of these, and I'll leave 20 minutes at the end for questions. And so the first two superintendents will have about 20 minutes combined.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Chair. My name is Ed Schmidt. I'm superintendent of Multnomah Education Service District, serving the Portland region.
Appreciate the opportunity to give you a very brief overview of the regional service delivery model in Oregon. There are four areas identified that local districts can expect from their ESD. They are programs for children with special needs, technology support for school districts, school improvement services, and general administrative and program support. I'd like to address the first issue, the programs for children with special needs, talk about the efficiency and effectiveness of providing these services regionally, and also address the issue of why large school districts and urban areas need ESDs for different reasons, but as much as small and remote parts of the state. Excuse me. The good news is that most of the students in our state, and most states, probably 80%, benefit quite adequately from traditional schools and traditional settings. But there's still a significant number of children for which traditional schools are not the answer. Many of these young people have disabling conditions that hamper their education. These can be physical, mental, psychological, behavioral, or health-related. The more severe the disability, the more likely that the family or the group home would be located in or moved to a metropolitan area that offers a variety of medical and social services. There are also other significant numbers of students for whom regular schools just don't work. Oftentimes these students drop out, get into trouble, become gang involved, and even end up in the justice system. Educating these students to help them become contributing members of the next generation takes extra resources, specially trained staff, specialized facilities, smaller classes, adaptive technology, in short, a number of conditions that local districts are hard-pressed to provide. Their primary mission, local school districts, is to educate the large majority of students to increasingly higher standards, both mandated by state and federal law. This is one of the areas where regional services make the most sense. Although statistically they may be classified as high-cost, low-incidence students, the numbers of these children in metropolitan areas are in the thousands. Perhaps you saw the picture in yesterday's Oregonian of the autistic student in the early childhood program in Multnomah County. It's a program we operate. We serve every year 1,500 preschool-age students with disabilities, preparing them for entry into the public school system. Now, each of our local districts sends students to that program, and we employ probably about the same number of staff that the local districts would if they operated the program
The significant difference is that we only have one administrative structure to operate that program for 1,500 students, not seven or eight. So that's where the savings come in consolidation of these kinds of programs. This combined model helps focus the expertise of the staff we can hire and the economy of scale to serve these deserving children and their families. Those are the preschool children. Once school students reach school age, those with the most severe disabilities or most challenging conditions continue to benefit from the specialized services provided by ESDs. Local districts want to keep as many of their students as possible in their neighborhood schools, but this doesn't work for a number of students with special needs. And it's not just students with identified disabilities. There are also English language learners, many young people disenfranchised from their local school who have dropped out, face a bleak, undereducated future for them. Be they pregnant, parenting, expelled, gang involved, incarcerated, and education is the only way back. And this is what ESDs do. This is our student population that we serve. I'd be very happy to answer questions after Mr. Mabbitt continues his conversation.
Mr. Mabbitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. First of all, I want to thank you for allowing us to have this opportunity today to talk about the ESDs of the state. ESDs are designed to deliver cost-effective regional services so that each and every child in every school district in Oregon has equal access to those services. In addition to services that benefit all students, special needs children are directly served by every ESD in the state, and specialized staff are required to carry out the services for those children. Inherent in every ESD resolution plan is the foundational concept of local control. Local school district personnel partner with ESD personnel to create a plan that will meet the unique needs of the children in a particular area of the state of Oregon. Those plans are then approved by the school boards of those local districts, finalizing a real true partnership. I am Jim Mabbitt, superintendent of the Northwest Regional ESD, and we serve the students in Clatsop, Columbia, Tillamook, and Washington counties. We have 20 school districts that are located within our region, serving 95,000 students. We have districts ranging from 500 students to districts of 35,000 students. It's quite a range in number of students, and there's also a geographic difference, rural and urban, within our region. What I want to talk to you about today is school improvement services. School improvement services is a department that's very important to all of the schools within Northwest Regional ESD. One role the Northwest Regional ESD serves is that of liaison between the Oregon Department of Education and our local school districts. As a part of that partnership, we provide support to our districts in meeting state and federal mandates, such as title programs under No Child Left Behind, working with schools in needs improvement status, implementing and interpreting statewide assessments, and assisting with their consolidated improvement plans. We employ outstanding specialists in these areas so that each district and school can be sure that they are receiving quality support and they can have confidence in the results. In addition to these compliance services, our school improvement department also provides requested services in the areas of training and staff development, attendance services, English language learners, and professional technical education. Within the area of training and staff development, our specialists provide a professional development model that builds capacity at the district level and throughout the region. The majority of our programs involve a model that works to develop teacher leaders, and they in turn work to train others in their school or district, regardless of the size of the district. We work within all content areas and use only those methods backed up by solid research and best teaching practices. The result is a model that can be replicated for school improvement throughout the region and the state, and it has. Our ESD also provides several attendance officers that work with our schools and families to maximize school attendance. We all know that improved attendance results in improved learning. Our attendance officers are making a difference, and in fact, they will be reporting to our board next week as to their significant progress in helping the students succeed in our local school districts. with our English Language Learner Program. We have a significant increase in this student population in our region, and our ESD is reaching out to work with all of our school districts to assist their English Language Learner students to become more successful in the classroom and in life. That program is very successful, and all of our districts are utilizing it. Finally, our ESD plays a major part in facilitating professional technical programs within our region. This is a partnership between our local school districts, our community colleges, and universities, and the ESD. We have programs located in all four of our counties, and we're continually adding to them each year as the need for professional technical education programs grow. One example of a program in our region is the Capital Center, located in Washington County. This program allows our local high school students to take classes such as robotics, law enforcement, and computer programming while receiving dual credit from both their high school and the participating colleges and universities. This partnership has been a huge success. The majority of our ESDs in the state of Oregon provide some form of school improvement services. These are just some examples from Northwest Regional ESD, but the partnership between our school districts and our ESD and the Department of Education to make this happen is solid and is successful. Thank you.
Questions?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for coming, and it's good to see you again. Each of you have particular differences in your situations. Superintendent Schmidt, your ESD has, for example, Gresham Barlow, which is in two counties. And could you let us know how that's handled? And then Superintendent Mabbitt, your ESD recently underwent a change where one of your counties joined a different ESD. Could you kind of discuss that a little bit? Thank you.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. Representative March, thank you. Even though Gresham Barlow School District has a small portion of it in Clackamas County, the entire school district is part of Multnomah ESD. We also have the same situation in the western region where part of the Portland District is in Washington County, but it's served by Multnomah ESD.
Thank you.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative March, our ESD consists of the students in Clatsop of Columbia, Tillamook, and Washington counties, and those four counties merged together into one ESD in 1995, and it's been consistent since then. So those are the four counties that worked together and merged back in 95.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
A statement and a question also. As a representative in the building before, I had territory that was in two ESDs, both Clackamas and Northwest. Now I have territory that's in all three metropolitan ESDs. It was actually kind of difficult for me, even when I had two, when we went through the equalization issue, because the Northwest was one of the lowest funded, high population ESDs. Clackamas, I believe, was about in the middle, and Multnomah County, although not at the top when you compare it to very small ESDs that have to serve a number of very specialized needs for children also, Multnomah was one of the higher ESDs. How equalization is now virtually complete, I believe, except for some exceptional cases. How has that worked out in both of your ESDs, you having been one of the higher, you having been one of the lowest?
You want to start at the bottom and work up?
Well, Mr. Chair, we share an interesting situation because just prior to coming over to Northwest Regional ESD as superintendent, I was serving as a school district superintendent within the Multnomah ESD region. The equalization clearly is the right way to go. It's, we We need to have students having access to the same kinds of services all over the state. With Northwest Regional ESD, the additional funds within the general fund has allowed to have the kinds of services that are present within Multnomah ESD accessed by all of our students within all four counties in the region. Back in 1995, when the merger occurred, there were varying differences of the four counties that came together, but when they did merge together, you're right, Northwest was the lowest in the state in terms of dollars per ADMW in our ESD region. Consequently, it was very difficult at that time to have a comprehensive set of services to apply across the entire region. What we had is a resolution plan that wasn't adequate, and districts spending quite a bit of their own dollars on contractual services. Now we have fewer contractual services and more resolution programs, so that districts have more money going into their classrooms.
Chair, members of the committee, from Multnomah County's perspective, I think a little historical view is important, that back in the good old days when voters could pass tax bases, that's how the Multnomah ESD funding got to the level it did. Voters chose to pay property taxes to have those regional services in Multnomah County. When the equalization plan was developed, we were the greatest donor to equalization across the state. It was a very difficult decision for our local board, our component district superintendents. We realized that we were going to lose about 30% of our basic revenue over the five-year equalization process. We are 1 year away from reaching the point of equalization, 2006. We have adapted in a number of ways. One is we have certainly tightened our focus. We have eliminated some programs that were specialized for just a few of our customers but couldn't substantiate the overall demand. And our districts have also stepped up to contract back with us with their own funds for some of the programs that they would have lost otherwise. We are currently the recipients of a short-lived income tax surcharge that the districts are also using to continue those services. And we have a very active foundation that is out trying to raise funds to provide continuity of services like outdoor school, for instance, and academic all-stars, and some of the things that have been traditional in Multnomah County for many years but are threatened by equalization.
Follow-up, actually. I'm trying to figure out how to say this with it not coming off in a negative fashion. It's a Representative Jensen said that his interest is, and I didn't mean Representative Jensen in a negative fashion, I just meant his interest is in how well children are being,
I'm getting nervous,
children are being served. And my interest is similar. And in general, when I think about how legislators react to this kind of discussion, to the extent that they can see people actually providing services to children, is to the extent that they understand and accept probably the importance of the work that you do. To the extent that there are people sitting back in offices discussing good things about what we could do for children, they don't have a lot of empathy for that. To some extent, I think one of the things we would hope to do in this process of looking at ESDs is to make those distinctions. How much of your work is actually providing direct service to children on the ground that is essential for their development in school, and to what extent there are people sitting back in offices talking about what is good for education and not providing those services. Understanding that there's an importance in planning, there's an importance in evaluation, et cetera, but that's the general, I just want to put that on the record, that's the general feeling I'm getting from legislators in this building, because their principal concern is how many students are in their classrooms back home, how much resources that teacher has in that individual classroom, and how good of a job they're able to do. So I just wanted to put that on the record. Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you. And thank you both for coming here. Take a couple things away from your testimony. One was in the urban areas, you're worried about special needs kids and the demand that has, and also on maybe gangs and gang-related activities, different things. In my part of the country, we worry about cougar tracks and sending our children to school. I mean, there is this cultural divide there. But I guess the question that's always going to come down to me, and what I'm hearing about the knock on the urban ones, is that you guys are providing services that are duplicative with the districts, and so that there's going to be a cost saving. So could you address that in some manner, shape, or form?
Yes, sir. The difference between what the ESD does and what the local districts do in the urban area is that the service, the students we serve are not part of the local school district. They have either been suspended, expelled, they've dropped out. They are non-students for the most part before we get them. These are the alternative ed students. We teach in all the county and state facilities in Multnomah County. So they would not be in school anywhere. We're not duplicating something that the district is not doing. We're providing them with an education. With the disabled students, we have the most severely disabled of the students. We have 25 classrooms across Multnomah County with functional living skills students who have multiple disabilities, physical, emotional, mental. These are the ones that are very difficult to serve, very expensive to serve, very specialized services. They were not being served in their local school. So it's a tier of the student population. We don't serve across the entire population, duplicating what our local districts do.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, in Northwest Regional ESD, we have 85% of our employees, of our total employees, 85% of them are working directly with special education students. So that's obviously the major thrust of our ESD program. But we have other departments such as technology, school improvement, which I went through, and other areas that help to support the students in our region. But again, our primary thrust is within special education. All districts participate. And there isn't any repetition because exactly for the reasons that Superintendent Schmidt mentioned, those students were serving directly where the school districts are not. Senator Devlin, we absolutely have to plan. We do have employees that plan and work together to make things happen, but I appreciate your comments. We are working every day to find efficiencies within our ESD to make sure that we are using every taxpayer dollar to the premium for the success of our students.
Any additional
questions? Yes. I mean, so will the school districts want to take over those services at this point? Do you have any sense of that?
My superintendents tell me they are not interested in taking over those services. They would needlessly have to build back the infrastructure that is there, multiplied by 8. And I mean, that's the basic bottom line cost efficiency. These are highly specialized, expensive services, providing services to these students. And number one, they would have trouble staffing them 8 times over. But number two, it doesn't make economic sense for them to do that. That's why they pool their resources and bring them together in a regional service center.
So there's some similarities between urban and rural.
Yes.
Right. Senator Whitson.
Chair Devlin, gentlemen, I'm a little confused, and that's probably just am confused, but the school districts have received a double-weighted contribution per student for special education people, and the education service districts get 5% of the discretionary budget for that purpose, and I'm hearing that most of your expenditures or preponderance of your expenditures go to special education needs. Are we grossly being underestimating the cost of special education students, or is there a double funding there? Could you explain that to me?
I wouldn't want to say we're grossly underestimating the cost because I think we know what the costs are. We are not addressing the true cost of these special needs students. Double X is about $10,000. Typical student in our special ed program costs $25,000 to $35,000. And I think there's other legislation that's talking about 3X and 4X for high-cost students. These are not the learning disabled who need a resource room, a teacher who visits a classroom that the 2X works for. These are the severely disabled students whose education is very expensive.
Yes.
Chair
Devlin. I believe in the formula there is a special grant for high-cost special education individual, which is 5X that the districts are receiving. Do they send that money to you for you to use in this process, or are we? That's the disconnect that I'm trying to get at.
It works different in different ESDs because of the arrangement that the local districts have with the superintendent. Typically, it's a pooling of those resources. They have to apply for the 5X. There's not enough money in the budget for all of them to be covered, so it never does address the full amount. But in our case, we charge an amount for the student that the district would contribute that matches an amount we put in to get to that $35,000 figure. So it's a combining of the resources that we get directly through our 5% with what the district gets with its high-cost special ed costs.
So then, to be clear, the school districts do transfer part of that money to the ESDs for that service?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
To stay on schedule, we should probably move on to the next two superintendents. Thank you very much for coming. Mr. Rose, why don't you come up with them also so we can make sure to get to your presentation at the end. And we have about 30 minutes left.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Maureen Casey, and I'm the superintendent of Willamette Education Service District. I'm also a survivor of two ESD mergers that have taken place in the last 8 years. The first one was with Polk ESD. We had Polk and Marion ESD merged, and that's when Marion and Polk became Willamette ESD, and then we recently merged with Yamhill ESD. We serve 21 districts in our ESD region, and we serve the second largest school district in the state, and we have three districts that have fewer than 300 students. Falls City has approximately 160 students this year. We also serve Woodburn School District, whose K-12 student population is 70% English language learners. Actually, that's not correct. There's 70% Hispanic Latino students, and another 13% happen to be Russian population. We also serve Jervis, that's about approximately 67% Hispanic Latino population. And our charge is to help those districts be successful in meeting the achievement needs of their students and providing all of their students with equal access. So we have to be pretty flexible in terms of meeting those needs. I've been asked to provide you with an overview today of the technology services that ESDs provide. And technology is the great equalizer, and it happens to be a perfect example of the critical role that ESDs play in this arena. And even though, you know, in some of the technology services, they don't equate to direct hands-on experience with students, I would submit to you that it's right up there in importance with indoor plumbing. The open system, which is the Oregon Public Education Network, that is supported and operated by the education service districts in this state, was responsible for connecting every school in Oregon to the internet. Every school would not have internet connectivity had it not been for the open structure of ESDs. We happen to be a technical center, an ESD open technical center, as do the other ESDs who are before you today. It means that we've met a set of standards that ensure state connectivity for all of our constituent districts. The stability requires an infrastructure that's comprised of things like emergency power generators so you can't go down, redundant internet paths. We have to ensure that we're meeting the federal requirements in terms of the Children's Internet Protection Act and have content filters and spam filters. Very sophisticated routing and switching mechanisms. We provide the routing equipment to the districts. It would be prohibitive for each school district to have to come up with their own infrastructure, and it would be duplicative. The connectivity, we engineer and facilitate the installation and the maintenance of the least cost routing connectivity. It means that our specialists are out there all the time negotiating pricing for the entire region that ends up being more cost efficient than any single district would be able to provide. Desktop support, our technicians in just our three-county region take care of over 25,000 desktop computers for students and teachers and administrative staff. And because of that economy of scale concept, they do it in a much more cost-effective way. When it comes to training, we have everything from how to turn on the computer, how to do spreadsheets, to bringing it right into the classroom, working with teachers on instructional technology. We offer classes, but we also have specialists who go into the classroom and team teach with classroom teachers. Hosted software. Software is extremely expensive for districts. We are able to buy licenses for software and host them on our servers at the ESD in a secure data center. The districts then save not only on the software, but they also save on their own servers. Here's a great example of a support service that doesn't get counted in that 59% of instructional services that goes into the classroom, but let's think about what a service this is to districts. We operate an electronic substitute management system. We host and maintain substitute management and dispatch. So we have over 3,000 substitute teachers and classified employees, and we provide an electronic means for the teachers and staff to request substitutes over the phone or over the internet. Again, districts wouldn't be able to afford a system like that on their own. The software is prohibitively expensive. It pays for itself over time, but you have to implement it up front, and we do that by having a pool of districts who come together in a consortium and choose to access it. We provide all of the human resource management of those subs. We do the background checks, ensure that their licensures are current, and we schedule their work. Another example is the Students Recycling Used Technology Program that the funding went away for on the statewide ESD basis, but we maintained it in our agency. And because of our proximity to a lot of government agencies, we have a lot of computers and used technology that gets donated to us. And we refurbish them and provide them to our districts at no cost. Last year, just last year, we placed over 1,350 used computers in classrooms in our region. We have districts that their entire lab is made up from computers that we've refurbished and given to them. Web hosting, we host the websites for most of our small school districts. It saves them the expense of having to purchase and maintain individual web servers, and also they don't have the technical expertise of the people who provide those services. ESDs help make things happen. And the governor's office right now and you and the State Department of Education have all identified technology as an area where efficiencies can be realized. And on the big picture is being sculpted, the vision, the dream of having an integrated, unified system that everybody participates in and they all talk to each other. That cannot be realized. You cannot meet your TESA goals. You cannot meet the state submission goals. You cannot consolidate and have a viable K-12 system network without having what we call the last mile in place. And that's what's available there in the classroom for teachers to access. So it's wonderful what's available to us right now in terms of video streaming, instructional technology. But if the classroom teacher, if the district doesn't have the bandwidth that they need to access those resources, teacher can't use it. So right now, the ESDs are conducting a study and analyzing the needs of the additional bandwidth that would be required to get the dream from the dreamers into the classroom, into the hands of the teachers, and onto the desks of the students. That will be the study that then helps to form the needs. It's a needs assessment that will help the ESDs then assist the districts in getting that technology into the classroom. The districts won't have the ability to sustain that network, and it would be relying on their ESD technology infrastructure and the technology centers to assist them in maintaining that. So as Deputy Superintendent Vicki Fleming likes to say, I guess this is a good example of how the ESDs are truly the rowers of the educational enterprise. That concluded my testimony. However, she made a reference to something that I wanted to acknowledge, and that was she hoped that I would mention to you the Oregon-Mexico Education Partnership. And it has to do with school improvement, but it also is a great example of what we're able to do in the arena of technology. We formed a formal partnership between the State Department of Education, the Government of Mexico, and Willamette Education Service District. And then we used the ESD structure, and we are currently piloting curriculum materials from Mexico that are housed on two servers based at Willamette ESD. We don't need a server in every district. We don't need a server in every ESD. We only need one server that would cover the students in the state. And Mexico has a national curriculum. So all of their literature, their content material is standardized. And so they are making all of this available to us. It's housed on the server. Districts and teachers and students can access these materials. They are using it for content area instruction in Spanish. They're using it for credit retrieval, credit accrual. Students who are going through the curriculum are able to take their GED and pass it in Spanish. So what we're faced with are a number of students whose primary language is Spanish, and while it's requiring an average of two years for conversational discourse, it takes 5 to 7 years before they acquire the technical vocabulary, content area language that allows them to access our classes. So what's happening is, educationally, they're stagnant. They don't have the English skills to benefit for some of those content classes. So we can't put them into calculus. We can't put them into social studies. So what we're able to do now, through the use of technology and this pilot, is make those resources available to districts who have students that then can benefit from the content in their native language while they're learning English. And this should help make a significant difference to many of our students in terms of their academic achievement. With that, I'll close. Thank you.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity. I'm going to address the part of the plan that's related to the administrative and program support, and I'd like to state at the outset that the reason that every ESD in the state looks different from every other ESD is because of what we think is a great check and balance model system, because all of our resolutions, which equate to a regional service delivery plan, are adopted by members of the locally elected boards. In my case, in Lane County, that's 16 of those. Board members from those same boards also serve and occupy more seats on our budget committee than our own board members, and then our superintendent council weighs in. So the way that we look in Lane County and the way that everybody looks is basically a function of the oversight of those groups to recognize that we're responsive to our local districts, not growing something out of the ground that's the way that we in a back room would design it. I provided a packet, and I'm not going to address everything on there, but the bottom of the first page under the flexibility speaks to a second point where, if you look at our total expenditures for our case, it says $37,467,000. 8.8% above that is our unappropriated ending fund balance, which we already have a two-year plan in place in partnership with our districts to spend that fund balance down, which is additive to the state school fund formula to get them through the upcoming biennium. where it says resolution dollars, $14,482,000, and it says 117%. That's because above that you can see that what we get from state and local resources is $13,802,000. So when you hear about the 10% overhead that we take off the top, that's a complete misnomer, because in our case we're spending 117% of what we get in resolutions. The other point that's embedded in there is that total pot that comes from the state sources is only about one-third of what we expend. So our districts also benefit from two-thirds that we aggregate through the spreadsheet that Vicki Fleming provided you, through consortium grants, through private resources, through contracts, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't want that to be lost on the fact that when somebody says, I may not be getting my fair share of the resolution dollars, they're getting more than their fair share because we bring to the table that much more. Our largest districts particularly are probably at this point with our superintendent councils the most vocal that they would not like to be exempted or allowed out of the ESD structure, because they don't want to take on the managerial function and the training and the identification of staff to replace it. Even if they had their dollars, they could not replicate the infrastructure that supports them. On the second page of that, I identified on the extremes in our county, we have Blatchley School District that's 122 students and Eugene School District that's 18,000. So speaking of that administrative program support at the top of page 2, in Blatchley, we provide everything in that district that's in the form of an administrative or a technical or a support specialist outside of our superintendent and business manager. We provide the curriculum function. We provide the special ed function. We provide the building level administration, the policy function, on down the line. In the second smallest district, which is Crow Applegate Lorraine, they provide those specialist functions and we provide the superintendent and the business manager functions. Again, not to say that that's the correct answer in every case, but to say those are tailored to the specific needs of those small districts. All of our 16 districts in Lane County, 14 of them we have on the same software for business services and student services. We don't provide the software. They buy those services, but we are then able to provide support so that we can fill business manager services and student services for an individual district. And on at least six occasions in the last 2 years, we have provided terms of 3 to 6 months where we provided business manager services in the interim while they were looking for somebody else. In the government support heading at the bottom of that second page, there's a list of what we think we do. It's already been alluded to with the ODE Partnership for Communications Technical Assistance. A lot of what the administrative and support functions comes is not a design that's grown from the ground up. That's a statutory compliance. And so the people that are providing the special ed services and the technology services and the Division 22, if you look at that, are local districts, about 12 of our 16 have absolutely no capacity. So we're the go-to people when we do their continuous improvement planning process. We're the ones that do their performance audits. We're the ones that do their data collection and disaggregation interpretation when it comes to the assessment piece. All of our media collection that has grown to be over 250,000 pieces is cross-referenced according to Oregon benchmark standards. So even our largest school district that would use that collection on 40,000 occasions in a single year would be able to call up and access that not by title or author or content area, but by specific application to a specific Oregon benchmark. We think that's value added. We do also subcontract so that the dollars that come to resolutions are not the only dollars. We have contracts that we administer through Lane Community College, the University of Oregon, 4J, Springfield, and those. If they have capacity that is already online that outstrips where we would be by starting from scratch, we contract with them. Those are value added than the real dollars in their budgeting process so that they don't have to perform that function. And as I squeak quickly, because I know Ozzie will strangle me if he doesn't get a time here. The last page in there is kind of a very brief review of that spectrum that I alluded to that shows Lane ESD, our two largest districts, Eugene, Springfield, Crow Applegate, Lorraine, and Blatchley, the small ones. And you can see that in where it says ADMR, that means that Eugene has 38.7% of the students in the county. Out of strictly the resolution funding, they get 35% of those dollars that are really dollars to them to purchase services back from us. That doesn't account for another 35% of the other $22,000 that they're getting, and I didn't put that on there because I'm just trying to say what custodians we believe we are for the state school funding formula. You can see that they only receive 24% of what we would call the annual or daily contacts with their students. That would be as it's expected because their need is more for dollars and less for capacity and contacts and specialists because they already have those. Over on the other end of the spectrum where you can see Blatchley, who's only 0.3% of 1%, they get three times that in direct service dollars, but they also get four times that in contact specialists. That's the district that I mentioned. We have five or six people there on a weekly basis to do those management functions. So for us, it's not a case of the big versus the small benefiting. We believe that everybody in our ESD benefits on an equal basis, and that's not a judgment because we have the wisdom of Solomon or anybody else. That's a judgment that's based on a collaborative effort of getting all of those school districts together to adopt our resolutions. Thank you.
Mr. Rhodes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ozzie Rhodes. I reside at 1323 Jordan Drive South in Salem, and I'm here representing the Association of ESDs, and I want to share with you a little bit about the, quote, plan that they've developed over the last 6 months. Responding to the need for change as well as the continued discussion of how many ESDs are there and how many should there be. I want to do a little bit of history and then I'll get done in time. There have been 9 studies of ESDs since 1965. 4 of them recommended a reduction of the number of ESDs. That was done in 1968, 1972, 1993, and 2001. Those recommendations came to the legislature. 1 year, the legislature referred that issue to the people, and it was defeated. It was tied up in some change in taxes as well. Twice, this issue died in your committees. And once, it resulted in the actual reduction of from 29 to 21 ESDs, and subsequent to that, one of those has voluntarily merged, so we now have the 20. The most comprehensive study that was presented to the legislature in terms of total content and recommendations was in 1999. You had appointed a legislative task force to work in the interim, and the task force was made up of 6 local district representatives, 6 ESD representatives, and 5 legislators. So it wasn't a profession-driven thing. They met throughout the interim, and they came to you with 27 recommendations, 25 of them by unanimous vote of the task force. 2 of the recommendations were not unanimous. One was 11 to 4, and one was 13 to 4. And guess what? Those two dealt with how many ESDs there should be. All groups fall down in this discussion when they start looking at boundaries and maps. The 2001 legislature, by the way, adopted most of the funding recommendations in that report. And that's led to our 95-5 split, the 90-10 between resolutions and operations, and the move toward equity, which, as you've been told, we're almost there. But again, the legislature dropped the issue on changing boundaries and messing with maps. And I only share that with you to emphasize that it is not a new issue, nor is it an easy issue to address. So then, so what? Where are we today? And ESDs, by the way, since they were first formed, have been designed to serve the needs of local districts. And so they've changed in their mission over time. And I think it's clear that with the intrusion, what I call intrusion of the federal government, and increased interest on the part of the state government, because now most of our funding comes through the state rather than locally, there is more interest in, maybe more responsibility. I think maybe you're assuming more concern over being a school board than you need to, but that's a different discussion. But there is a difference than what we had a decade ago. We have increased demands and intrusion on the part of the local schools by the state and federal government. We have moved from a locally funded to a state-funded system. We've decreased the capacity of the Department of Education to perform the traditional task of training, curriculum support, school improvement, and technical assistance, and have asked it to focus more on regulatory activities and accountability issues.
there's an increasing role of technology across the educational system and what it can do. There are lots of new opportunities for efficiencies in regional services through the use of technology. Some of the studies, I think you've probably seen the paper recently, there was our youngsters in some of our rural areas have access to 40 different courses, and our youngsters in the urban areas access to 400 courses. Well, that's always been that way to some degree. I went to a small rural school. We didn't have the same things they had in Seattle. But the fact is, with technology, we have a chance to correct that or balance that out some. And you know all this. And there's going to be a continual shortfall of resources against the demands for services. I don't think that we're going to grow our economy to the point that we can fund all the things that people think government ought to provide, or some people think, in terms of education, health service, etc. So that's an ongoing battle. It's not going to get over in the 07 session or the 09 session. So the question before us now is, can we, through the use of regional agencies, improve what we're currently doing and strengthen the possibility that all kids have access to a quality education? Some but want to focus on the blasted maps and how many is it. That is not the fundamental issue. Now, there are issues when you talk about change, and there is an issue about distance, and there is an issue about supervising staff. All these things have to be thought about. But the core issue isn't a map. The core issue is, how do we get the best services, get the most economy, most efficiency out of the system? The proponents would tell us that we need change, and if there's going to be a reduction in cost, we're going to save money by making these changes, reduce the number of ESDs, and we're going to have better programs, etc. Opponents will tell you that the actual savings will be minimal and kids will suffer. The fact is, there should be some cost savings if you reduce the number of ESDs. And there should be, if it's done right, better services. Having said that, such savings and service improvements are not likely to materialize unless some thought is given to the mission of ESDs before we address the maps and the merger ideas. And that's what led our association to say, what is it that is added in value in terms of to the total enterprise by a regional agency? And that led to the paper that you have in front of you. And we try to focus on what really can be done that will help the system in terms of help it make it efficient and deliver a good product to kids. By the way, we first developed the regional service delivery model, which is laid out for you, and the people ahead of me have talked about the area things they currently do in this area. What this actually does is tell us we focus. These are the things that ought to be done and done better through a regional agency. And there's one other thing I'll add. The last page or next last page in the five I took for you under the title Implementation, a slightly new concept that takes a look at the issue now where we have the feds and the state driving more things through the accountability standards, etc., but still trying to let local districts be local districts and respond to the needs through their locally elected officials. How do you mesh that together? And this implementation says you develop a regional service plan, and annually it's developed by the ESD and its component districts, and it is reviewed by the Department of Education. So you develop some ability to drive what they want done at the state level, but let the implementation be driven by local decision makers and still have some accountability that it works, that it meshes together. The last page says, okay, we think these things, this is a good model of what needs to be delivered. Now, what kind of an agency would it take to do that? Not just what does the map look like and we draw boundaries because for where you get the most votes or whatever, but what would it take an agency, what has it got to be like? So we try to develop some criteria, and one of the criteria is geography. It does make a difference how far people drive. It does make a difference if there are good roads. It does make a difference if there are mountains, etc. So you have to pay attention to that. It also makes a difference on how many districts you're trying to serve. We've often talked about the minimum number of districts, but it also makes a difference in maximum. If you have too many, if you're trying to serve 40 districts, you're going to have a more difficult issue than if you're trying to serve. And by the way, this is the thinking of people who do this. And somewhere in the 7 to 20 range, they believe is the right number. And there ought to be at least a couple of them that are fairly good size by Oregon standards, because you can build your infrastructure around what those districts have to offer. You need enough staff to carry out the core mission. And we have a minimum number of students. Essentially, that's a minimum. You're driving at a minimum. You need a base budget to have an adequate infrastructure. And because we distribute our money on a per student basis, we chose to describe this in this terms. And for those of you that worry about our geography, east of the Cascades does not include Klamath County. Klamath County is in the west of the Cascades, and that's because Klamath County is already in an ESD that starts in Jackson County. So that's all. I just want to be sure we know geography.
Mr. Rose, we have about 2 to 3 minutes.
Okay, I just got to make one more point.
And I'll ask you to make one more point within that point, or in addition to that.
Okay.
You have about 10 of the ESDs, at least, as being present on this. Could you comment on where the other ESDs are in your...
First of all, this is a set of criteria. Well, the last one was that you need one public institution, either community college or college, inside the ESD, again, to work on the infrastructure questions. This is a set of criteria. You cannot build every one exactly like this. This is quasi-objective. Now you'd have to take this and apply it with some subjective judgment and some political reality. And Willow County. Ed says, this works fine. You just hook me to Union County. Well, it works fine. It doesn't meet the criteria about minimum kids, but it does address a geography issue. Now you got to wait. Which one are we going to pay attention to in making that choice? Coos Curry and Douglas would have to be joined in this one to meet the 30,000 minimum that we've suggested. That creates a long L-shaped organization, geography, mountain, whatever. You'd have to look at that alongside the need to get to the 30,000 that we suggest they ought to have in this. So that's how you would use this criteria in determining what your map ought to look like. This was developed by a committee appointed by their executive board. The 10 people at the bottom are the committee that developed this. It was approved by a 9-1 vote and submitted to the executive committee, which is a broader group and the decision makers for the group. And it was approved 12 to 4. So it's not unanimous. Just like the task force report, you have trouble getting unanimity because they don't know where these maps wind up when you get to that level of discussion. Now, the amount of money to be saved is the other issue that you're interested in. There will be savings in some dollars because you're going to reduce some positions. There will be costs in other ways. And you can't really get to the exact savings till you say, okay, here's the merger we're going to create. Your gentleman at Union has, or not Union, Umatilla, has done some looking at another one and kind of figure out what he could do with business services in terms of, and there'd be some savings. There'll be some other cost. You have to balance that in some manner. But the issue ought not be just savings of money. It ought to be, can we have better services and do more kids get treated better? And your remark, Senator, Malheur County is so well run, it returns part of the money to the system. With all due respect, Ed's a really great guy, but the major reason it returns money is that they have a high taxing base for the number of kids they have, and so they drive that over the per student thing.
Still return the money.
Though. Well, I understand that, but I mean, but
and, with all due respect,
but the issue is the relationship between the amount of dollars available per kid and so forth, and so all that stuff needs to be looked at again with the goal of better services, more kids getting what they need, and there would be some efficiencies. If you follow this criteria, we believe you would come up with 12 to 15 ESDs. Now, it depends on how you applied the criteria. And again, some subjective judgment will be involved, and you guys will probably bring in some political issues when you try to make those decisions.
One of the things before we'll close here in about 30 seconds is, and I think maybe, do you have a question, Representative Wisnett? Or?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Is that, in general, one of the directions, I don't believe in here explicitly, but the previous reorganization of ESDs, at least the last one, the direction was given to the Department of Ed and Board of Education, and that's probably part of your recommendation too, is that we set the general direction and they, along with the various ESDs, determine the specifics.
Ms. Chair, it can be done that way. I believe once we said these counties are going together.
Yeah,
because I recall that the battle over that, and for instance the merger she talked about, Willamette, Yamhill, and Polk were going together, and you had legislators who decided Yamhill shouldn't do that, and they fought hard, and they kept Yamhill out. And 4 years later, Yamhill said, wait a minute, the local district, we want in the other one, and they merged voluntarily. But it was done here, I think, at that time. Another time it was done voluntarily.
Thank you all for your presentation, everyone that's presented today, for coming. We will be adjourned until tomorrow morning.
Chair, we